Ever feel like you're supposed to fit in a box? Like your passions should have neat little labels. Today we're diving into a career that throws those boxes right out the window.
Okay.
We're talking about composer Jeff
All
Harrington,
right.
a guy who went from Juilliard to Sesame Street. Buckle up, because this is one wild ride.
And it's that refusal to be categorized that makes Harrington so fascinating. He's a Juilliard-trained composer, absolutely, but also a tech enthusiast, a game designer, someone who could go from hanging out with Frank Sinatra to writing software that composes music.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit. I mean, you say Juilliard, and I picture this serious, almost intimidating world of classical music. But then we hear about Harrington helping Sinatra pick out a stereo system. That's not exactly what I picture when I think classical composer.
Yeah, and I think that juxtaposition is key to understanding Harrington. Think about it. Here he is studying under legends like Elliot Carter and Roger Sessions, immersed in this very specific world of atonal music, and yet he's also working at Liberty Music, rubbing shoulders with icons of popular culture like Sinatra. It's almost like he's exposed to these two completely different musical universes right from the start.
So it's not just that he had these diverse interests, but that those interests might have actually influenced his approach to music. Like maybe that early exposure to both high art and pop culture made him more open to blending genres, to breaking down those traditional barriers.
Exactly. And it's not just speculation. Harrington himself talked about feeling this tension at Juilliard, this pressure to compose with a certain kind of angst that was expected in atonal music at the time. But coming from those joyful Southern roots, he felt conflicted. There's this great anecdote about him asking Elliot Carter, "What if I want to express J joy in my music?"
And Carter basically told him he'd never have a career if he did that. Talk about a creativity killer. But it does make you wonder, was Harrington already sensing this disconnect between what he was supposed to feel as a composer and what was authentic to him even back then?
Absolutely. And that conflict comes to a head in a really dramatic way a bit later in his life. This is where things take a turn, and we see Harrington's willingness to completely upend his own path.
You're talking about the period after his brother's suicide, right? That was a turning point for him, both personally and artistically.
Right. It's a time of immense personal tragedy for Harrington, and it forces him to reevaluate everything, including his music. And his response is radical. He essentially throws away years of work, symphonies, string quartets, even part of an opera.
Wow, that's a bold move. What made him do that?
He had tried to force himself into this box of tonal music after Juilliard, but deep down it didn't feel true to him. He realized he was composing to fit someone else's expectations, not his own.
That takes incredible self-awareness to recognize that and have the guts to hit the reset button on your entire career.
It really does. And it speaks to this core theme of Harrington's journey. Being willing to start over to follow your own compass, even when it leads you in unexpected directions. And in his case, that compass was about to lead him right into the world of computers.
Wait, what? Computers? How does a Juilliard-trained composer who was hanging out with Sinatra end up in the world of computers?
It's actually not as strange as it sounds. This is the early 80s, the dawn of personal computing, and Harrington, always the curious mind, dove right in.
So instead of composing symphonies, he's suddenly writing code. That's quite a shift.
It was, but it wasn't a complete break from his artistic side. In
Yeah.
fact, this is when he starts designing games, even creating some of the very first online games for, of all things, Sesame Street.
Okay. Sesame Street games. That's amazing. It's like this unexpected but perfect example of how Harrington could blend these seemingly different worlds. But it also feels like a bit of a detour. Did he ever go back to composing music seriously?
Oh, absolutely. He never really stopped. But for Harrington, it seems, exploring new technology wasn't a distraction from his music. It was a way to push boundaries, to find new ways to express himself creatively. And that leads us to what might be one of the most intriguing parts of his work, the Counterpoint Program.
Okay, remind me, what was that exactly? Last time we talked about it, I think I pictured some kind of musical robot, like Harrington had taught a computer to write like Bach or something.
Well, in a way, you're not far off. But it's even more interesting than that. Imagine instead of a robot composer, you've got this superpowered musical collaborator. See, counterpoint is this really complex musical technique where you've got multiple melodies playing at the same time, weaving in and out, creating this intricate tapestry of sound.
Okay, like a musical tapestry. I like that. But I imagine it's really hard to actually compose that way.
It is. It's like a puzzle where you've got to fit all these different musical lines together so they sound harmonious, but also interesting and surprising. What Harrington's program did was essentially automate that process. It could take a melody And using these complex algorithms based on the rules of counterpoint generate all sorts of variations and combinations.
So he wasn't just copying Bach or other composers. He was using technology to explore the possibilities of counterpoint in new and creative ways.
Exactly. And to me, that's what makes Harrington such a fascinating figure. He's not afraid to embrace technology, but not as a replacement for human creativity. He sees it as a tool to enhance it, to push the boundaries of what's possible in music.
It's like he's constantly looking for new ways to merge his passions, whether it's high art and pop culture or technology and traditional composition. And speaking of technology, this is all happening right around the time the internet is starting to take off, right?
Absolutely. And once again, Harrington is ahead of the curve. He sees the potential for how this new technology could revolutionize the way music is shared and experienced.
Mm.
And he becomes a huge advocate for online music distribution way before it was mainstream.
He was basically predicting Spotify, iTunes, all of that back when most people didn't even have a computer at home.
He was. And like anyone who sees the future, he recognized both the incredible opportunities and the potential pitfalls. He knew that just putting music online wasn't enough. You needed ways to organize it, to help people discover new artists, to deal with things like copyright and making sure musicians were fairly compensated.
It's like he was looking decades down the road and recognizing the challenges we're still grappling with today in the music industry.
Exactly. And what's interesting is that even as he's embracing digital technology, he's also grappling with these bigger questions about the nature of music itself. Remember that comment he made about classical music lacking bass?
Oh, yeah. How could I forget? I remember thinking, did Juilliard trained composer really just say that? But when you think about it, he kind of has a point. There's a certain visceral energy you get from some music that maybe traditional classical doesn't always have.
Right. And it's not that he thought one was better than the other, but that he recognized this tension between different approaches to music.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't afraid to explore both sides of that coin. He loved the possibilities of electronic music, but he also deeply valued that raw human element you get from acoustic instruments.
And that tension between the acoustic and the electronic, that's something that plays out in his later work, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Even as he's composing for synthesizers and experimenting with electronic sounds, he never abandons acoustic instruments. In fact, you could argue that some of his most interesting work comes from finding ways to blend those two worlds.
And this is where his story takes another interesting turn, geographically speaking, because we haven't even touched on his decision to move to Avignon, France. What prompted that?
Well, for one thing, he was living on Sanibel Island in Florida at the time, and the BP oil spill deeply affected him.
Right. That was a major turning point for him. He talked about how it exposed a kind of recklessness, a prioritization of profit over the environment that he found deeply troubling.
Exactly. And it wasn't just about the environment. It was a symptom of something larger than he saw happening in the U.S. So the move to Avignon wasn't just about escaping something. It was also about embracing a different pace of life, a different set of values.
So he finds himself in Avignon surrounded by this rich history, this completely different culture. What impact did that have on his music?
It's fascinating because you can see how the move to Avignon coincides with this new phase in his work. He's still composing for both acoustic and electronic instruments, still exploring those seemingly opposite ends of the musical spectrum. But there's also a sense of, maybe integration is the word. Like he's finding ways to bring all these different parts of himself together.
And we can't talk about Jeff Harrington without talking about Acid Bach. I mean, that title alone tells you this is someone who's not afraid to push boundaries. For those of us who aren't classical music experts, what exactly is Acid Bach?
Well, it's actually a series of preludes written for something called a quarter tone synthesizer. Now, most Western music is based on a 12-tone system, but quarter tones divide those tones even further, which creates this wider range of pitches and harmonies. Imagine taking the familiar landscape of music and suddenly discovering all these hidden valleys and peaks you never knew existed.
So he's literally expanding the possibilities of music itself.
Precisely. And he's doing it in a way that's both intellectually rigorous and playful at the same time. He even talked about using his trusty counterpoint program to help him create these intricate interlocking melodies within this expanded tonal system. It's like he took the DNA of Bach, injected it with a little bit of psychedelic rock, and came up with something completely unique.
It's funny, though, because even with all his experimentation with electronic music, Harrington never abandoned acoustic instruments. He seemed to believe there was something irreplaceable about that raw human energy you get from a live performance.
Yes. He talked about how, for all its possibilities, electronic music can sometimes feel a bit sterile. Like it lacks that certain something that comes from a group of musicians playing together in real time.
He even said that in some ways electronic music is actually more fragile in the long run because of the challenges of digital archiving. It's not something you'd expect a tech guy to say.
Right. It's like he's reminding us that technology is a tool and it's up to us to use it in a way that serves our artistic goals. Sometimes that means pushing boundaries and embracing the new, and sometimes it means going back to basics.
And that's what makes Jeff Harrington such a fascinating subject for a deep dive. His career path is anything but a straight line. It's more like a choose-your-own-adventure story full of unexpected twists and turns. But through it all, there's this sense of curiosity, this willingness to embrace seemingly contradictory passions and find ways to weave them together into something truly unique.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really important lesson for anyone, creative or otherwise. We often feel pressure to fit into these neat little boxes to define ourselves by a single passion or profession. But Harrington's story shows us that it's okay to embrace the messiness, to follow our curiosity wherever it leads us, even if it means going from Juilliard to Sesame Street and then on to something completely unexpected.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the life and work of Jeff Harrington, I'm left with this question. What seemingly unrelated passions do you have? What might happen if you found a way to connect them, to weave them together into something that's uniquely you, something that might surprise even yourself? Food for thought. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.